This is 89.9 WWNO. I'm Janae Pierre, and it's time for All Things New Orleans. On today's show, we'll chat with Preservation Hall's Ben Jaffe. Then Jessica Rosegard joins NOLA.com, the Times-Picayune's Kevin Litton, to discuss a public safety ordinance under consideration by New Orleans City Council. Then we'll share another story from Bring Your Own. That's all coming up on All Things New Orleans. Stay with us. From here with Chris Thiele is stopping in New Orleans for a live nationwide broadcast this Saturday. Special guests for the big show include Grammy winner John Prine, Sylvan Esso, and the city's beloved Preservation Hall Jazz Band. Ben Jaffe joins me now. He's the creative director of the Preservation Hall Jazz Band and the hall itself. Ben, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And I should mention that you play both bass and tuba in the band that was co-founded by your parents. Let's start right there. For the most part, you grew up at the hall, right?
Yeah. I shouldn't say just I, but our family, we lived on St. Anne between Bourbon and Dauphine. And Preservation Hall actually used to be my parents' home. They used to live in the courtyard behind Preservation Hall. They never really changed the courtyard and the cottage in the back of the hall. It was their apartment, and they left it their apartment, and it still, you know, still has all of their artifacts back there.
Now, speaking of change, you actually became part of the Preservation Hall Jazz Band, taking after your father. Let's talk about that transformation.
Yeah, my father passed away in 1987, and when I finished my education in 93, I came back to New Orleans and joined the Preservation Hall Band, basically, you know, taking over the chair that he had filled for, you know, since the 1960s. And mm-hmm. Also, the much bigger role, but the less public role of being the custodian of this incredible organization.
Did you always feel that would be your future?
I never dreamed of running the hall, but my dad did instill inside of me and my mom a entrepreneurial spirit, where you see a need. And then you see how you can use your talents to address that need.
A lot of people know the band for that traditional New Orleans jazz music. But your most recent project, So It Is, has a little bit more of a Cuban influence. Let's talk about that, because you are one of the composers behind that album, correct?
Yes. I worked on most of the compositions with the eldest member of our band, Mr. Charlie Gabriel. And he's truly one of the shining stars of our music community, not just in New Orleans, but really the greater music community. He's really a treasure.
Yeah, and one of those native sons.
And
of a
native son, not just him, but you know, he's 85, and he is a fourth generation New Orleanian, and he's one of the people that inspired me to explore these other talents that I had, and that are, you know, something that most musicians possess, which is the skill to write music. Composition is something that has always been a part of my life, but in the Preservation Hall Band, that meant something very different, because when I joined the band, the members of the band were still the musicians who had played with my father for 20 years. You know, mm-hmm. people like Willie Humphrey and Percy Humphrey and Narvin Kimball and Frank DeMond. These musicians had inherited a canon, this body of work that comprised the repertoire of New Orleans. Mm-hmm. What I discovered was sort of a creative void in my own life, and also this change that was happening around us. We weren't changing, but our audience was disappearing. And that was when a lot of my friends in music outside of jazz started encouraging me to start writing original compositions specifically for the Preservation Hall Band. And that's when Charlie and I really became writing partners. And that's when we began writing. This isn't our first album of original material, but it is our first album that has such a strong Cuban and, you know, Afro-Cuban influence on it.
And with all that said, you know, you mentioned traditions changing. How receptive is your listening audience to that?
Oh, it's been unbelievable. Our audience is bigger today than it's ever been. And that's amazing. As an artist, you wonder about that. You wonder about the work that you're creating and the impact that it's going to have.
Live from Here with Chris Thiele is coming to the city that we both love this weekend.
Mm-hmm.
And you guys are listed as special guests. I'm sure you're excited about that.
It's really beautiful. First of all, what Chris has done with Prairie Home Companion, which is not an easy role to fill. Those are very big shoes that you have to stand in, and there's a big shadow that is sort of cast over that institution. And in many ways, it's, he and I talked about this, it's very much the shadow that in many ways, you know, that I've stood under with Preservation Hall. So me and him have connected very, very closely on that. Two different musical worlds and two different histories, but parallel sort of.
Yeah.
And to bring it to New Orleans, I mean, that's right there. That's amazing, you know, that he's able to take this show and bring it, you know, around the country and tour with it. And, you know, that's a whole nother creation, mm-hmm. you know, that may not have ever happened.
And speaking of tour, you guys were actually featured on the show with Chris about a month or so ago. What's going to be different from that time, besides the fact that it's in New Orleans, of course?
Yeah, that was our first time as the Preservation Hall Band performing on Prairie Home Companion.
Mm-hmm.
And it was an incredibly beautiful experience for us and for Chris and for his team and all of the other performers on the show. You know, musical relationships are oftentimes like a first date. You have to grow comfortable being around somebody, and you have to know a little bit about them. You know, you have to sit down across the table from them and share a glass of wine and talk about life. The music oftentimes is the thing that is secondary to this relationship that you have with one another, with collaborators.
Mm-hmm.
And Chris is exactly that kind of person. It's an honor to be on the stage performing alongside, you know, luminaries,
yes.
other musical luminaries.
Ben, before I get you out of here, we mentioned all the hats you wear. We mentioned that you're the creative director for the Preservation Hall Jazz Band. But we failed to mention that you're also the creative director for the hall itself.
Right.
What does that mean? Because that's a huge umbrella.
It is. It's you know, Preservation Hall is such a blessing to our community and to our community at large. You know, we have live music at Preservation Hall 360 days a year. That means that there's two dozen musicians every day that are walking through that door to make music and to have an impact on people's lives and audiences from all over the world, you know. And it really is an international audience. You know, that's another incredible thing. It's like, how many venues can you go to where you'll have people who represent every continent mm-hmm. sitting in a room that can only seat 60 people? That's amazing. It's like this United Nations
yeah.
of music, you know. And that's something I'm very proud of, that we do that we have a real impact. And I don't know any other music hall or venue that presents as much music as we do annually. And our foundation is conducting classes weekly. We have you know, field trips from local schools come to the hall on a weekly basis. We're going into the community and doing workshops and master classes at schools and in the youth detention centers around Louisiana. And it's something I'm very proud of, to see what the hall has grown, what it was, and what it's grown into.
Yeah, because you've been there the entire time.
Pretty much.
That's a beautiful thing.
It is a beautiful thing. And actually, I mean, it is beautiful to see my mom and, you know, for someone who really was there
mm-hmm.
at the inception, to see what it's become now. And it's really gone beyond what so far beyond what she ever imagined. It's gone beyond what I ever imagined, but not what I dreamed, but what I ever thought was possible.
That was Ben Jaffe, bass player and creative director for the Preservation Hall Jazz Band. Thanks for joining me today. The New Orleans performance of Live From Here featuring the Preservation Hall Jazz Band takes place this Saturday, January 20th. Tickets begin at $20 and are still available at singernola.com. The New Orleans City Council will consider a public safety ordinance before the end of this term, including a provision to expand the city's camera surveillance capabilities, and local organizations are lining up in opposition. WWNO's Jessica Rosegard sat down with NOLA.com, The Times-Picayune's Kevin Litton to discuss the details.
Kevin, for those who don't know, let's set up this issue. Where did this ordinance originate, and what are the surveillance specifics?
So the surveillance piece of it is a part of a larger plan that came out in early 2017. It was about 2 months after the Bourbon Street shooting that occurred at the Bayou Classic. So there was a real need for the mayor to get out front of a lot of public safety issues. Some mm-hmm. of them were more terrorism-related, concern about Bourbon Street needing to maybe have some bollards, have some safety measures there. And the big thing that came out of it early on was that the city was going to have their own public surveillance network that they were going to set up. Much of it along Bourbon Street, but they were going to put it in some hotspot areas too. So one thing that sort of didn't get discussed a lot was the ABO side of things, which mm-hmm. is the alcoholic beverage outlet. And the idea was that they were going to require ABO outlets to install cameras outward facing, so all pointing to the outside. And this didn't really get talked about a lot because there was so much attention paid to the work on Bourbon Street mm-hmm. and the public surveillance network, which is pointed at areas like Jackson Square and areas that are really highly traversed downtown. And so it's really come to the forefront now because the council's facing this deadline to try to get their ordinances scheduled before they leave office in May.
And that real-time crime monitoring has organizations concerned, like the American Civil Liberties Union of Louisiana and the New Orleans Independent Police Monitor. They're saying the cameras are a threat to personal freedom, and the ACLU even calling it government surveillance on steroids. Why are these organizations so concerned?
Well, I think that there are certain areas of the city where you would expect there to be some surveillance. Jackson Square is a great example. Bourbon Street's another great example. Places where people are going to tend to congregate, places that people are going to be at late night, and places that have been kind of crime hotspots. I think what's given people a lot of concern about this is that it would expand it so far throughout the city. I mean, there's 1,500 places that have ABO licenses. If you install two cameras on every building, that's 3,000 more cameras. Mm-hmm. That's 10 times the amount of the public cameras that are going to be set up. And this idea that you could be kind of in a quiet neighborhood spot, you know, I certainly have some quiet neighborhood bars that are set back into the neighborhood, and that those cameras are going to be, you know, pointed at you when you're at night, going to work, kind of hanging out. I think it's started to give people a little bit of a creep factor here. Mm-hmm. I think one of the other things to consider with this is that the cameras feeding into the real-time monitoring center can be really turned on at any time. Mm-hmm. Just this idea that it could be used for other things that are not just crime-related mm-hmm. gives people a lot of concerns.
You know, you started off mentioning that this whole conversation came up after that Bourbon Street shooting, and that was different because while there are cameras, those cameras had to be accessed after the fact of the incident. There has to be a cause for the police to access that video as opposed to the constant streaming situation.
Yeah, that's right. And I think most ABO license holders would tell you that they really have no problem cooperating with police, and that most of them, when police have come out and asked for footage when a crime has occurred, they've always provided that voluntarily. But this does change the game a little bit. I mean, a crime can occur and then the real-time crime monitoring center can get access to that right away. They can pull it off the cloud. If they get a crime that's reported long after the fact and it's within that two-week time period, then they could go back, pull footage without that owner necessarily knowing about it. So I think those are things that have given the ABO owners a lot of concern.
Is there a crime prevention, crime solving or mitigating aspect to this?
I mean, I think it's interesting you're bringing up prevention, because in some ways, how do we know whether or not a camera has prevented from someone committing a crime? I think certainly there's an argument to be made that people are less likely to commit crimes if they know that the camera is on them. But on the other hand, criminals can also shield their faces. They can do things that can evade law enforcement in some of these spaces. So it's really hard to know. I think from law enforcement's perspective, I think they have a much greater comfort level in having cameras around because it provides, you know, much more convincing evidence should they make that arrest and should the prosecution move forward. What I think the ACLU and what some of the ABO owners are saying is, yeah, but does that really show that you're keeping crime down? Mm-hmm. And I think that's a really hard one to answer. And another point that ABO owners have made is that law enforcement hasn't really provided the evidence that there is more crime occurring around the ABOs mm-hmm. than in other areas of the city. So if you really want to reduce crime, I think the question that's being asked is, should you deploy a different strategy that targets the high crime areas, and why not require cameras in those areas? Why not invest more cameras in those areas if you really do believe that cameras do reduce crime?
And finally, talking about the city council, there was a hearing on this ordinance scheduled in December and got pushed back to January, and now it's been pushed back again. Why the constant deferments, and does this ordinance have the support to pass this sort of lame duck council?
I think it's really hard to tell at this point whether they're going to have the support to pass it. I think that's where you're going to see that amendment process really come into play, is they're going to be talking to council members and they're going to be saying, well, what do we need to do to get your vote for this? What I think is going to be the most interesting is the camera side of it, because that's really been where the pushback has been. And does the Landry administration get into this face-off with a huge range of different businesses, organizations, and some of the people that you would kind of consider the cultural bearers? I think those musicians and service workers are a huge part of the city's economy. And I think there are, you know, certainly the Louisiana Restaurant Association, cultural organizations have been pushing to get service workers and musicians to line up against this. So I don't know how that plays out. Mitch Landrieu doesn't have to serve, doesn't have to run again.
Right.
I think five out of seven of these council members don't really have to run again. So that does introduce a lot of uncertainty, and I think it will introduce a lot of uncertainty going forward. I think this one is particularly important for Mitch Landrieu because there's no guarantee that this would get picked up again by the next mayor.
Okay. Kevin Litton, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
That was WWNO's Jessica Rosegard and NOLA.com, the Times-Picayune's Kevin Litton. And we're back with more BYO. This story was told on September 28th at the CAC and later produced by Maggie Herman. The theme of the evening was The Thing Is. And here, Mac Dennis describes how he wound up at Angola Penitentiary in 1969 and kept up with row number one.
In 1969, you guys might remember I was in the Black Panther Party. And when they raided the house in the night ward that night, a friend called me and said, come on, they're raiding the house. And as I stepped out of the house, put my gun in my waist, my mama looked at me and said, boy, you done lost your mind. I said, Mama, Huey Newton said that master took my mind when he took my manhood. And if I could take my manhood back, I'd get my mind back. She said, I still think you crazy. She said, you could wind up in Angola or you could wind up dead. Well, you can see I ain't dead, but I did wind up in Angola. Here I was shackled to brothers I knew nothing about. We were trucked to fields in a hootenanny, tracked to pulling two long carts, trucked to field where grass abounds. A khaki-clad white man unlocked irons from my ankle, and he is insulting us. Say, Angola Penitentiary, don't try to make nothing easy for you. He shouts to my shoe as I look at his holster's pistol. The judge said, hard labor, and I am the enforcer, and he has insulted us. Say, grab a hoe and stand two to a row. If you want to run, inward, run. But long as y'all under my gun, you could keep up with row number one. This is 1969. And standing behind row number one is a greasy black inmate guard with a shotgun. He's wearing a lighter shade khaki than his boss, spits out tobacco juice just like his boss, and will kill you quicker than his boss. And he too is insulting us. Cut my grass, leave my green, hold that row, you so-and-so. Show me what you got, row number one. And them two country field on row number one is going so fast. But you see, I have no problem catching row number one, because I'm from Vashon, Louisiana, and I come from peace work on plantations. And I know how to cut the grass, leave the greens, and chop the dirt that's in between. But my row buddy, he handles his hoe like a, pardon my expression, a b-. And I am helping him, because he's still my brother. There's an old con on row number nine come up to me and say, you can have that boy now that you carried him. I said, no, thank you, sir, because I can't see myself shackled to a bad relationship. So I keep on helping me shave the grass. But when we get back to lockdown and he finds a love letter on his bunk, can't save his I know why the snakes left me there, because they tried me when I was a fish. And when they say on my oh blood on my shank, I say, it's best you kill me, because I worked too hard for this manhood, and it's going to last me until I die. God, I am so tired. I got to rise with the sun. I got to keep up with row number one. Angola, Angola, Lord, they working me hard. Angola, Angola, two more summers and I'll be gone. Angolia. The good thing about it is I'm like Peter Rabbit. You take something bad and make something good out. So my experience in Angola, I put it in a book and I sell the book. So thank you.
That BYO was in partnership with Project Object and the Stacks Bookstore. The next BYO is tonight at 2645 Tulu Street, right next to the Broad Theater. The theme is Pipe Dreams, and stories will focus on the floods of summer 2017. Doors at 7:30 and stories at 8 p.m. More information at bringyourownstories.com.
What? 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 Ah!
That's it for this week's edition of All Things New Orleans. I'm Janae Pierre. Visit our website to check out previous shows, and be sure to catch us next week, right here on 89.9 WWNO New Orleans and 90.5 KTLN Thibodaux Houma. Thanks for joining us.